From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. The Stephen Salata appointment at the University of Illinois, where the board did not confirm a faculty appointment approved by the hiring department, reveals big disciplinary divides in academe. And a new report from EDUCAUSE discusses the current status and the future of learning management systems. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note that you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our first segment today, we'll discuss the two-culture issue and the reaction to the Stephen Salata appointment at the University of Illinois. British physicist and novelist C.P. Sow's 1956 Two Cultures essay, expanded into a book in 1959, stemmed in part from his conversations with colleagues in the humanities who expressed their, quote, incredulity at the illiteracy of scientists, end quote, but who, Snow noted, could not describe Newton's second law of thermodynamics, which Snow deemed as important as Shakespeare for the educated individual in Western societies. Widely cited but less often read today, Snow's Two Cultures essay has become a reference point as humanists and scientists find themselves on different sides of controversial campus issues. A case in point is the reaction to the decision of the chancellor at the University of Illinois not to advance the appointment papers for Stephen Salata to the Illinois Board of Trustees for final confirmation, although he had been approved by a hiring department for a tenured position. A petition signed by Illinois faculty supporting the chancellor overwhelmingly reflected the signatures of faculty in the sciences. In contrast, a public letter supporting Salata and chastising the chancellor and the board are dominated by the signatures of faculty in the humanities. Is there something in the culture of the humanities and sciences and in the training of faculty in these areas, science and the humanities, that might help explain this divide, not just at Illinois, but also at other institutions in the wake of campus controversies? Joining us for this conversation are David A. Hollinger. He is the Preston Hotchkiss Professor of History Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. And Scott Jasek, who is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, David Hollinger, let me start with you. Lots of people cite Snow. Not many people currently have read Snow. It was widely read at one point. The original essay was very short. The book was longer. Why does his positing of the two cultures seem to resonate still for us and seem to play out in these political issues?
Well, people are very much in need of a vocabulary to describe what is the different behaviors of what I like to call these two different families in academia, the so-called STEM fields on the one hand, and on the other, the humanities and the bulk of the social sciences. And there are differences there, and C.P. Snow's terms are often invoked to do that. It's frustrating, though, because when Snow actually developed his ideas, he was mostly concerned with literature, not even with the academic study of literature, although there was some of that. For Snow, the big contrast was between the natural sciences and engineering on the one hand and the modernist literary canon on the other, particularly Dostoevsky, D.H. Lawrence, Gide, people like that. So much of the book is an onslaught on the modern literary canon for being politically reactionary and socially unresponsive, while the scientists, they have the future in their bones, was the way that Snow put it. So it's a set of terms which we rely on without really adopting Snow's own understanding of what they meant. So we take the two cultures concept and we now apply it to much more broadly than he did. He didn't talk much about philosophy, didn't talk much about history, two of the most strategically important fields in academia, and he said almost nothing about the social sciences. Whereas now it's important to take all of those kinds of things into account. So I would say we're sort of stuck with his terms, but one disadvantage to us of being stuck with his terms is that the words cultures tend to ascribe to the two families, as I like to call them, more deeply structural characteristics and tend to diminish the things that they have in common. So I'm not happy with the two cultures term. We have to fight it. We have to work within it and modify what it means.
So, Scott, as a journalist, you've covered these kinds of issues for a long time. Two cultures seems to just be an easy way to set up a metaphor for how these things begin to play out on many campuses, the differences in perspective or the behaviors or the concerns of people in the sciences versus their counterparts in the humanities and potentially their social science colleagues in kind of gray areas, depending on how quantitative they might be. How tempting is it to fall back on the two cultures metaphor in terms of describing these situations?
Well, it's very tempting because even if the differences we see today don't truly match what Snow was talking about, you see very real differences. Now, obviously, there are exceptions to this, but generally, you hear a lot of talk in the humanities which perceives the STEM fields to be more favored, to be getting more money, to be getting more tenure-track jobs, and so forth. And so there's a real difference in money. And then you have political differences, and where this came up this week was in the Salada controversy, where there have been a series of statements and votes condemning what the University of Illinois did, almost all from the humanities and social sciences. While, as you noted, the chancellor, herself a scientist, who's perceived as strongly supporting the sciences, has gotten a lot of backing from scientists at Illinois. So on both money and politics, there is still a visible divide.
So we've seen this, though, play out in a number of places. The Inside Higher Ed article this week referenced the experience that Larry Summers had when he made some controversial remarks as president of Harvard and was subject to a vote of no confidence by the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. It wasn't clear where, because it was a group that included humanists as well as folks in the science, some of the sciences, which groups spread out, but other groups at Harvard were not included in that vote. At Case Western Reserve, on a money issue, one of you mentioned money in terms of the grant structure of the sciences versus humanities. When a financial plan collapsed, it was the faculty in the arts and science, in the arts, who voted to, who essentially did a no confidence vote in the president that ultimately led this to his departure. You know, how much of this now becomes about money as much as it does become culture, David?
Well, I think money does have a lot to do with it. I think that the, it's not simply a matter of perception. It's empirically warranted that faculty member, man for man, woman for woman, there's a lot more money going into the STEM fields than there are into the social sciences and humanities. And you can follow this in terms of salary gaps. I mean, at most campuses, say that have a law school, an engineering school, a medical school. I mean, those faculty members make two and often three times as much as scholars of comparable standing in their fields, in classics, philosophy, history, anthropology, and so forth. So there is a huge economic difference, and that is one part of the whole thing. I certainly agree with that. But politics has a lot to do with this as well. We need to remember that beginning in the early 1970s, with a famous memorandum that Lewis Powell, shortly before he went on the Supreme Court, wrote to the United States Chamber of Commerce, there has been a program, I would not hesitate to call it a conspiracy, to undermine the authority of the humanities and social science professoriate in American higher education and to transfer more and more authority over what goes on in that domain to trustees and groups of alumni. Now, this is the culture wars type of stuff that we used to read about from Alan Bloom and all those people in the 1980s. And that's highly significant here because you have political interest in the society that recognize that in the humanities and social sciences, you have a critical edge that is potentially disruptive of certain political interests. So the attack on the intellectual content of what goes on in humanistic scholarship and social science scholarship and teaching makes the period since the 1970s radically different than the earlier period, where political conflicts about academia mostly had to do with the private political behavior of folks who were accused of, or maybe even were, communists. So you'd have a chemist or an engineer who had been member of the CP when he was an undergraduate, and then you'd get flapped about that. That's not what's been happening since the 1970s. The conflict rather had to do with the intellectual content of certain fields and not others. That enormously changes the political landscape.
are there not also significant conflicts within the humanities, as we think about what's happened, particularly in literature and
yes.
other fields, that show a kind of internal two-culture divide?
There are certainly conflicts within the humanities fields. That's true. The humanities and social sciences are always subject to more debates within, because, as the great Thomas Kuhn pointed out, there's not the tight research consensus. I mean, these fields are different than molecular and cell biology or solid-state physics or string theory, because you don't have the same agreement on exactly what is being studied. And so the rules are more are up for grabs. The question of what an interesting topic is up for grabs. So in this whole humanities and humanistic social sciences area of academia, of course there are going to be more severe and open conflicts than they are in the classically natural science and engineering fields. That's true. I'm not sure that plays such a large role in the current situation, though. I think that there's always been a good amount of that, but it has been exploited, publicized, and subject to anecdotal attack by those parties that want to undermine the authority of the social science and humanities professoriate.
I want to turn to Scott on just that issue.
Of course.
These kind of internal
Please.
Divides within sciences, the definition of problems, in terms of new perspectives within. Scott, you've watched these things in terms of what we might call the internal two-culture issues in the sciences as well as the humanities.
Well, if you look at the sciences, what I think is interesting is that while they may be portrayed as more conservative than the humanities, and I'm not sure that terminology really applies, they are actually much more dependent on federal funding. And so in the post-World War II period, the reality is that sciences have had to be largely pro-government spending. When you look at, say, the sequester that happened when Congress and the President couldn't agree, the sequester had much more of an impact on scientists, Republicans or Democrats, than on humanities people who just don't get that much money. So the sciences are very dependent, one, on federal funds. Two, you have this dynamic where a lot of Republican politicians, citing the job market, sort of give a lot of generic pro-STEM, anti-humanities rhetoric. We don't need more anthropology majors, as the Florida governor said. The North Carolina governor said we don't need don't need women's studies. President Obama even sort of seemed to trash art history, although he apologized. So you have that strand. I also, though, wonder if we may see more of a change ahead, with many Republican politicians these days denying climate change is real, denying evolution. I wonder if we might see more of a politicization from the scientists as they feel their values are being attacked.
David, I want to come back to some of your work. As you characterize this as not so much two cultures but two families, you write that, in fact, scientists are involved in a quest to uncover evidence, while social scientists, humanists, are engaged in the quest to advance evidence. Many of us as civilians might think that there's just a small nuance of difference there, but I suspect there, you view that as being a significant difference between the two.
Well, I don't know. There's always the danger of getting the vocabulary that's not precise enough for something like this. Let me back away a little bit from that and suggest that it is helpful to think of both of these families in academia as pursuing a single cognitive ideal, which is that you're interested in basing truth claims on evidence and reasoning rather than on tradition and intuition. You're interested in stuff that is discovered rather than divined. Now, I would say that the bulk of the humanities and social sciences and all the STEM fields share that basic cognitive ideal. So I would not want to yield the concept of discovery only to the STEM fields. I would not want to yield the ideal of truth claims. I would not want to yield the ideal of empirically warranted assertions only to the STEM fields. The humanists and the social sciences do that as well. Now, that said, the big difference is that a lot of the domains explored by the humanities especially, and to some extent the social sciences, are pretty messy. They're complex. And so the rules of evidence and reasoning are not quite as clear. So these are risk-taking areas. These are areas where humanists and social scientists try to advance the shared cognitive ideal in areas where it's not so clear where you're going to go. And there's a certain amount of pressure to retreat from that risk-taking and go back to doing, multiple regression analysis or kinds of quantitative stuff that is more easily defended and less risk-taking. So I think that the big difference is the risk-taking character of the domains that you have to get into. And it's in that context that the humanities and social sciences, during the whole last 40 or 50 years, have led in developing like women's studies, black studies, I mean, all these studies areas where some pretty silly stuff has happened, okay, but a lot of progress has been made and important cognitive advances have then been integrated into the social science and humanities disciplines as a result of opening up that kind of space. So I think that there are risk-taking in all of academia, okay, but it's more visible in the social sciences and the humanities, and we're dealing with stuff that the average public thinks they know about even though they usually don't. And I think that the point just made about politicians wanting to impose more of their will on what goes on in academia, and that applies to the sciences as well as the humanities and social sciences, that's a real problem right now, and I think important as an occasion for the two families in academia to pull together to respect and support one another's risk-taking endeavors, support the scientists when they stand up in favor of evolutionary theory, support the humanists when they work in these areas that are also subject to public complaint. So
David, I need to turn to Scott about this issue of standing up, because a couple of things emerged from your comments and other things we've been talking about. First is that these kinds of events, where there two cultures may play out, can often leave scars that linger for a long time. You know, whether it's what's going on at Illinois, we see this potentially in terms of how the conversation about the boycott of Israel is playing out at some campuses. Scott, you know, you're watching this. What do you see?
Yeah, and I do see evidence of two cultures, although how much of it is pragmatism versus philosophy, I don't know. If you take the Israel boycott movement, while there are a wide range of views within the humanities, there is some momentum for boycotting Israeli universities within humanities disciplines and among humanities scholars in the United States today. At the same time, in recent years, we have seen American science grow much closer to Israeli universities, which have really experienced a lot of benefits from the tech boom and technology research, which is flourishing there. So you have sort of a non-political decision, or seemingly non-political decision, to ally with Israel in the sciences, where they say, hey, they're doing good research, let's collaborate, while humanities researchers who may have less going on with Israel are saying, let's take a stand and boycott. And then you look at the discussion about that, it's a totally different world. Now, how much of that is based on worldview versus just scientists wanting to collaborate with other scientists, I don't know. But it would be another example where we are certainly seeing what would seem to be two families or two cultures.
David, I want to give you a last quick comment, because we need to get from the conversation about what we're seeing to the conversation about remedy and resolution.
Right.
You know, as we close, and we have to close quickly, as you've watched this, as you see this, as you've studied this, is there a path to remedy and resolution between these two cultures at campuses and in the larger family of academe, or the two families of academe, that will bridge this divide?
One thing that would help, and this is a campus-specific solution, is very strong shared governance institutions, so that the folks in the STEM parts of the university and the folks in the other family see each other on a regular basis with institutionalized responsibility. And I have noticed that on campuses with really strong shared governance, like Berkeley, the gaps that we're talking about are not quite so severe, okay? And that is because the chemists and the physicists and the molecular biologists have come to know some of the philosophers and classicists and historians in ways that they otherwise would not in the course of high-level conversations about academic policy, personnel questions, advising the chancellor, and so forth. This makes a big difference, whereas if you have a campus situation where the leaders of the two families hardly ever see each other except to throw stuff at one another and make snide remarks now and then, that's a mistake, because they're all isolated with themselves, and they retail slanderous and libelous comments about the other group. Whereas if you actually get to know these people, and you're much more able to recognize the shared cognitive ideal that drives the leadership of the various factions.
So, David, it sounds like your recommendation is, in fact, people need to get out of their offices and get out of their labs and sit across the table with one another and see them as individuals as opposed to folks who represent their particular disciplines. Whether it's the faculty senate at Berkeley or it's the U.S. Congress, those person-to-person contacts are, in fact, one strategy to remedy the divide. Our time is out, unfortunately, but thank
Very
you.
Good.
And we are most appreciative of you joining us for the conversation about C.P. Snow.
Hi, this is Scott Jasek back from Inside Higher Ed. In our second segment, we're going to switch things up a bit, and I'll be the moderator so that Casey Green, normally in that role at this week, can be one of our guests. That's because we're talking about several developments in the LMS industry, which Casey tracks as director of the Campus Computing Project. Casey also, of course, writes about these issues in the Digital Tweed blog here at Inside Higher Ed. Also joining us is Josh Kim of the Technology and Learning blog here at Inside Higher Ed and Director of Digital Learning Initiatives at Dartmouth College. LMS news is timely as next week the leaders of technology in higher ed will be headed to Orlando for the EDUCAUSE annual meeting. In advance of that, the EDUCAUSE Center for Analysis and Research released a report this week saying that, among other things, while many faculty members and students want their future LMS to be customizable and full of features, they also tend to use the system's basic functions more often. Generally, the report found an underutilization problem with regard to the LMS. So, starting with you, Josh, what did you make of the ECAR report?
Thanks, Scott. Well, it's always great to see the numbers, and it's fascinating that 15% of our schools are thinking about turning over our LMS in the next 3 years. So that's interesting. In reading the report, however, I don't really buy the underutilization thesis that runs through the report. My thinking is that the LMS is really not that interesting anymore. The LMS is mostly infrastructure, and the real story is how schools are changing their investments in academic technology to try to move more towards mission, more towards teaching and learning, and less towards administrative functions. And that context was not in this report.
Casey, what did you make of the report?
Well, I'll give ECAR credit. They drew on three databases, their survey of institutions, a survey of faculty, and a survey of students. But there's a lot of ways that this report falls short. And it begins actually on page 3 with the first bullet, with the pronouncement, which is played out again and again in the opening pages, that the LMSs are 8 years old. In fact, as I recall, the actual question on the survey, it's when did you install your current platform? So campuses are constantly updating their LMSs. Technology providers are constantly offering updates. If you were a Blackboard campus in 2002 or 2003 and you're a Blackboard campus today, you've been through a lot of iterations in terms of current stuff. The same thing is true with Desire to Learn. Instructure does updates in kind of just in time every couple of weeks in terms of either bug fixes or other kinds of things. But the other parts of this report that concern me, one, there's no disaggregation of the data, or very, save for one table about what faculty want out of an LMS that disaggregates it by sector, and one cherry-picked piece of data about engineers versus computer sciences and their view of the LMS. What we get is a narrative that's a kind of a light narrative that aggregates all the data, as opposed to an insightful narrative that helps break this down in terms of important differences between sectors and segments. The student experience and the faculty experience in community colleges is very different than in research universities than it is in other areas. And we just don't get any of that from this report. And that, you know, for both the campus IT leaders and faculty who want to understand their own experience, as well as for the technology providers who are trying to do better, that could be really critical data, and unfortunately, it's just not there.
Josh, I want to go back to something you said a minute ago about how colleges are using the LMS for the administrative functions and then just sort of moving on to other ways to use technology to advance their missions. Now, a few years ago, it felt like the LMS providers were adding on all these academic features and new bells and whistles, and then ECAR's analysis suggests they're not using that. Is your point that they're just doing all those things outside the LMS, and does that make the LMS, less valuable?
Where the LMS has moved to, it's ubiquitous now, and it really is infrastructure. And all of us who work in academic technology are understanding that the answer to our questions about where we need to go with academic mission, whether that's retention or really improving authentic learning, that the answer is not going to be the LMS or a new set of LMS features. We need the LMS as infrastructure, but what we need to do, and I think what schools are doing, is starting to invest in whole teams of folks, in non-faculty educators, in instructional designers and learning designers to partner with faculty to improve courses. And again, that's really the story that's going on, and I think the focus on the learning management system is largely misplaced.
Casey, do you agree?
I do. I think I have a sense of semantic remorse in the marketplace. You know, when these systems began to emerge in the late 1990s and the early part of the last decade, they emerged because, first of all, most of them emerged because they were the work of students working for faculty members, or students who had a bad experience with some application and decided they could build a better digital mousetrap. The LMS, as Josh said, does a lot of things. You know, it's a way for faculty to put their stuff up on the web, like any other software application, whether it's an LMS, whether it's a presentation package like PowerPoint or a word processing application or a spreadsheet. 80% of the activity is always in 20% of the features and functions. So the designers keep adding stuff on for the outliers, and most of us just still keep using the core functions out of time, out of expedience, out of we don't have time to get the necessary training, or because we're not getting good training, or my campus doesn't offer good training. The LMS is a really good data aggregator. I'm on record some years ago in a piece I wrote for Inside Higher Ed characterizing the LMS as the higher ed equivalent of a supermarket scanner, in the sense that it's sort of one way we get unobtrusive data about student activity. It's not an ideal way, but at least it gives us some way of kind of time on task. And as higher ed moves to big data, we're seeing more and more campuses and their tech providers aggregate that data with other data about student activities and academic performance into predictive analytics and feedback to students and also to faculty members.
Josh, in your blog today, you posed a bunch of questions, including asking which company will be the breakthrough vendor. Now, that looks beyond the LMS, but as you think about the LMS folks we're about to meet, what are you most interested in finding out from them?
So with the LMS folks that we meet, I'll be asking a couple of questions. The first question goes to Casey's point about analytics and data. I think it's very much true that we're at the point we need to bring evidence to our practices and our investments. We need to bring the same culture of research to our teaching. And now we're doing this mostly blind. So if the LMS providers can actually provide data, usable data in the form of dashboards to help us really understand what's working and what's not, that will be very important. So that's a very big trend. The other big trend is, of course, mobile. With the iPhone 6 Plus coming out, it's really clear that many of us, and particularly our students, will want to interact with their classes and their educational technology on their phones or their mobile devices. And the LMS experience on mobile is still not really good. The systems were designed for the browser. So I'll be looking towards how they're thinking about very much reorienting towards mobile.
Casey, what do you think we should be asking the LMS providers?
I think we should be asking them about how they're going to transform their systems and make them sticky. It goes back to my comment about semantic remorse. Well, when these systems were designed initially, they were designed for faculty to put stuff up on the web. So the focus was on course management or learning management, involved to learning management. And the real challenge is, how do you get students drawn in? How do these systems engage students and also support faculty members? And I think the real challenge for the providers is, can you make the system safe for faculty? Will the faculty want to use it? Do they see value in it? Do they see do they see that it will help their efforts to help their students? And for students, it's a matter of, again, how will this help me as opposed to impede what I do? The add-on of a lot of features and functions really works for folks who are not part of the core, but sort of the next circle out, if you will. And that's okay. You know, just as there are a lot of advanced functions in Excel and Word that none of us use, but they're there for those who might need them either now or at a later date.
Josh, another story we had this week was looking at Lynn University, which is dropping its LMS in favor of a mix of services provided by iTunes U, but then for attendance and grades, they're building their own. Do you think we'll see more colleges and universities build their own LMS or parts of an LMS, and is that a good trend?
You know, I love the story about what Lynn is doing. I don't think that other schools will be building their own, but I think it points to what we want and what a lot of our students want is something that is mobile first and very simple. I think that if the legacy LMS providers were smart, they'd spin off their own branches to compete with the mothership, that the Instructure and Blackboard and D2L would spin off a group and they'd offer a stripped down, bare bones, mobile first LMS environment. And we would see where the market would go. It's a real opportunity for someone to step into this space.
Casey, what did you make of the Lynn development?
Well, I think, you know, Josh nailed it. You know, what they've done is they've stripped it down. I think one of the challenges with mobile is that if we look at data from my campus computing survey, almost from last year at least, 2013, almost half of campuses that have activated mobile are actually doing their own apps. They're not getting them from the providers. It suggests that student talent and student time is a resource that many campuses want to tap as they go mobile. That's a windfall for institutions, but it's also a challenge because, of course, students leave and the code remains. And how do you go forward in terms of updating and keeping it current? I'm not perhaps as fully convinced that mobile on a small phone as opposed to mobile on a notebook in terms of at least certain reading activities and exam activities are comparable. It's John Stewart at one point in the Academy Awards presentation made fun of watching Lawrence of Arabia on an iPhone. So, you know, it's sort of the appropriate device for the appropriate task, I think.
Well, lots for us to watch next week in Orlando. Thanks very much for your thoughts today.
We thank you for joining us this week, and our thanks to the individuals who aided and informed our conversations, David Hollinger at the University of California, Berkeley, Joshua Kim at Dartmouth College, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoons on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comment section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.